is My Daddy Station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, it's one of those absolutely fantastically beautiful days in the state of Arizona. It's very strange to walk outside and be bathed in the most beautiful sunlight with the most crystal clear, cerulean blue sky that you can possibly imagine, with just a few little brilliant white puffs of clouds floating off in the distance. It's warm, with just a slightest little chill in the breeze, and it feels just wonderful. And for this time of the year, it's a little unusual, I can tell you that for sure. The wind should be blowing. It should still be a bone-chilling cold up here in the mountains at 7,500 feet where I live. There are quite a few things happening, folks, that you should know about. Number one, Anthony Lake has asked the president to withdraw his nomination for director of the Central Intelligence Agency, or somebody is trying to call. And they don't know that you just don't do that when we're on the air. It's Connie's day off. If you're trying to get through to Connie, she has taken the day off to go on a trip with her husband, so you're not going to reach her while I'm on the air. I'm the only one here, and until I take calls later in the broadcast, you're wasting your time. So I say that so that you'll know not to do it. Anthony Lake was probably one of the worst choices for the director of the Central Intelligence Agency that could possibly ever have been made. If you study his history, his politics, his speeches, and his writings, it is clear that Anthony Lake is a Marxist socialist, maybe even a communist. He has been involved in some of the most un-American, shady activities that you can imagine. And for good reason, the confirmation committee was going after him tooth and nail. Well, Anthony Lake is no fool, ladies and gentlemen, regardless of what else he may be. He saw the handwriting on the wall, and so he wrote a letter to William Jefferson Clinton, the head communist in government, asking that his name be withdrawn from nomination. And so Anthony Lake, it appears, is gone. But the same person who appointed him is now going to appoint someone else. The question is who, and how much worse than Anthony Lake can he be? Even if he's not as bad as Anthony Lake, he's still going to be a Marxist socialist, of that you can be sure, because that is the nature of this administration. In the state of Kansas, there has been a bill, HB 2058, introduced. And it's an act concerning crimes, punishment, and criminal procedure relating to certain crimes involving information and computers. It's a 3-page bill, and maybe a little confusing to some people, but it appears, ladies and gentlemen, that this bill makes it a felony. Now listen to me carefully, not a misdemeanor, but a felony to pass on any information that is false. Now remember, this bill concerns certain crimes involving information and computers. Now, if this is true, a lot of people in the state of Kansas are going to go to jail. I can tell you that right now, because most people spend most of their lives passing on false information, rumor, outright. Outright lies, if you want to know the truth. We did a survey once. We collected all the information that we could collect from the Patriot Facts Network and from the rumor mill and from documents that people were mailing all over the country to each other, all purporting to be genuine and true. And we gave ourselves a certain specific amount of time. I think it was 1 month. It was a long time ago. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was 1 month. If it wasn't 1 month, it was close to it, give or take a week or two. And we collected everything that we could collect through all of these avenues of information, wheels, and networks, and faxes, and all kinds of things, and we put it together, and one by one, we completely researched every single bit of it. And ladies and gentlemen, what we discovered was that over 95% of all of it was lies. Now, a lot of it, I'm sure that the people who passed it on didn't think it was a lie and weren't intentionally passing lies, but that's the nature of people. Somebody gives them something, they read it, it has an authentic ring about it or an authentic look, and without checking it out, they pass it on to someone else as being the truth. So, number one, I sincerely believe that this bill is unconstitutional, and that has to do with the first article in the amendment governing free speech. And there, you know, free speech, you know, if they start doing this, everybody at some point in their life, if they're charged with this, discovered, is going to go to jail, because I don't know anybody who hasn't told a lie or passed on some false information innocently or believing that it was right at some point in their life. And even people who claim that they never tell a lie, which is a lie in itself, it's like people who are married who claim they've never had an argument. You know, I can't help it. Whenever I hear somebody tell me that, I just bust out laughing right in their face. And I don't mean to insult them, but it's just, I can't hold it back because it's just not true. It's funny that anybody would ever make such a statement, but some people do. And some people claim they've never told a lie in their life. And I don't believe that either. But even if they didn't ever tell a lie in their life, let's assume that there's someone who's as perfect, I shouldn't say as perfect, more perfect than any other human being that's ever lived, besides maybe Jesus Christ. And let's assume for a moment that they never told a lie in their life. I'll bet you if I stick with them for as little a time period as a week, I will catch them passing on some bit of information that is simply not true. Even though they may believe it is, it's just not true. So these legislators, if you want to call them that, sound like pretty stupid people to me, going to pass a law saying it's a felony to pass on information that is false. Now, folks, you would not be guilty of a felony if you could prove in court that you did not have knowledge that the information was false. But how expensive do you think that's going to be? How many lawyers do you think you're going to have to hire? And how many years are you going to be involved in this court process? And possibly, if this is a felony, and they discover you committed this crime, this terrible felony crime, you passed on some false information, you're going to be arrested and put in jail, because they always arrest felons and put them in jail at least until they can have an arraignment and the judge can decide whether they can, walk around on their own recognizance or pay some exorbitant amount of bail. So it looks like a lot of people are headed for big trouble unless the good citizens of the state of Kansas can defeat this bill. And folks, stuff like this, I can assure you, will start cropping up in other states. And this has to do with political correct thinking. It really doesn't have to do with false information, although they could use that to get anybody that they ever wanted. If they couldn't get them on anything else, sooner or later, somebody's going to pass on a rumor or some false information, or they're going to be handed a document from somebody, and they're going to believe it's true, and they're going to pass it on. And it's going to turn out to be false, and they're going to go to jail, simply because somebody didn't like them, or they were politically incorrect, or somebody wanted to get them for something. But that's really what this is all about, politically correct thinking. You see, if they change history, and if they change the truth to be the lie, and the lie to be the truth, as they're doing all over the place, and then pretty soon you're going to tell the truth, and in court it's going to be a lie, and you're going to get convicted of passing on false information. You see, it doesn't matter what doesn't matter what the law says, doesn't matter what you believe, doesn't matter whether it's true or false. If they have the power, and you have no way of overcoming their power, they can do with you what they will, and they're doing that. A lot of people are finding that out all across this country. A lot of people in jail who never did anything except didn't go along with the current trend of politically correct thinking. So, that's HB 2058. And if you live in Kansas, check it out. Investigate it. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. Let me see, what else do I have here? Got all kinds of things here, but I really want to get into something else that is, and I think I'm going to do that in just a couple of seconds. The computer is driving me crazy, as they always do, and computers work. They can be unbelievably efficient and necessary, and a lot of things would never get done without them, at least not without 1,000 people to help. You see, when a computer is working properly, it can do the work of 1,000 people in a very few seconds or minutes, but it would take 1,000 people maybe, you know, a week or two or a month to do. And I'm not exaggerating at all. It's the truth. And so, when they're working, they are a great boon to our efforts here. Fantastic research tool, writing tool, database, compiler, and searcher, and we even use it to analyze information, ladies and gentlemen. But when they're not working, I can't think of anything more exasperating or confusing. Even. Because even if you have the manuals and you know what you're doing and how it's supposed to work, it doesn't always work that way. And conflicts that aren't supposed to exist between different parts of the computer sometimes spring up with no explanation and, of course, no solution either. So it's trial and error, and discard this and put in that and change this pin and sometimes by doing these things, you cause a problem somewhere else, and sometimes you can make it worse. So, since last week sometime, I think it was Thursday, I have been surrounded by computer cards and computer skeletons and little screws and tools and wires and connectors and hard disk drives and software and everything that you can imagine trying to make these computers work. So if you're trying to send us a fax, you may do so, but you'll have to call 520-333-4543. That's if you're trying to send us a fax. Our 4578 phone works, but the computer is down. In fact, we have several computers down. It's as if, all of a sudden, some little demon got into our wiring system. It just went to work. And no, it's not a virus. Please don't send me faxes or anything else saying it might be a virus. Not a virus. First thing I checked, it's not a virus. It's just that a whole bunch of old computers decided to die at the same time. And so that's what we're involved in here. And Veritas number 15 has been delayed again, I must tell you, due to the fact that the editor-in-chief just had a brand new baby. And you know how that is. It's going to be disaster and confusion around that house for a while. And, of course, the baby and the woman of the family is going to get all of his attention. Veritas is going to sort of sit in the corner until all of the excitement and the newness and all of this stuff dies down. And plus the fact that all of our computers except one have died has just added to this problem. So as soon as all of these things get rectified, Veritas number 15 will be out and on the way to you. It would have already been out and on the way to you, except for these things that have happened. We seem to be plagued because we don't have great amounts of money. We don't have large amounts of volunteers. Well, food, we don't have any volunteers, to tell you the truth. We've got me and Annie, and we've hired Connie, and that's it. And in California, we have the editor-in-chief, who is Ken, and we have Bart. And that's it. We're working on the paper. So to do all of the tons and tons of work that we have to do around here, ladies and gentlemen, that, of course, normally would take any other organization or any other people, months or years to do, and huge, gigantic staffs of people and tons of money and large budgets and all kinds of things. We do routinely with nothing, with very little, with just the few people that I've named. And sometimes we do it very efficiently and very quickly. And sometimes when things like this happen, they drag out and it takes time and resources have to be brought together in order to get things done that sometimes don't exist. So I hope you will bear with us and be patient. And I want to thank you for the patience that you've already demonstrated. As usual, most of you are very good about that, understanding, as you have for many years, the type of situation that we are in, the resources that we have to use, and the lack of personnel and equipment and money that we are always plagued with. So there you have that, for whatever it's worth. And now we're going to get into, we're going to take calls later, but don't call until I tell you that the phones are open. We're going to take calls later, and but right now I'm going to get into some explanations of some things that you need to know, although many of you will say that you don't need to know it and it's a waste of time. I'm telling you right now, if you don't know it, you're helpless, you're without knowledge, you're without understanding, and you know, when you're standing on a battlefield in that condition, you're losing the war. And that's really the meat of the matter. You don't want to lose the war. You don't want to be on the battlefield in that condition. You don't want to ever be in that condition, on or off the battlefield. We must begin living our lives with knowledge in the truth. Because all of the other ways we've been living our lives is the reason we're in the great, terrible predicament that we find ourselves in today. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to preface the rest of this broadcast with this little statement. A lot of what you're going to hear me say today is going to make some of you very angry, because some of you are caught up in some of these deceptions that I'm going to talk about, and you have no idea what you're involved in or what the symbology of the ceremonies in which you participate really mean. And I want to tell you this, that I am not telling you this information, I'm not giving you these revelations to make you angry or to hurt you. For if you're an American, I love you, and that's the truth, and that's why I've devoted my life to service to this country and to the American people. That's why my family and I go without an awful lot of things that a lot of you enjoy every day in order to do the research and create this radio station and this radio network and the research organizations and the newspaper, all of the things that we have done in order to educate the American people and bring them out of deception. I want you to understand that I'm going to be bringing you this information, these revelations, if you will, in order to help you see the truth, to find the truth. And whether you decide to do that or not is your business, because I believe wholeheartedly in freedom. And your right to make your choice and believe whatever you want, to belong to whatever organizations you wish, to adhere to whatever religion you wish, worship on whatever altar of your choice that you choose to worship upon. But I believe in order to make that choice, you need to have information. You need to know the truth about some things. And I know that many of you will resent that because you don't like to know that you've been deceived. Because that makes us feel stupid when that happens. It makes us feel little and insignificant. And of course, we fight that. And we practice denial. And we put off any kind of truth that tends to make us feel in that way. And I hope that we can learn not to do those things, not to resist the truth, not to fight the truth, but to look for it and accept it and embrace it lovingly For it is the truth that sets us free. It is the truth that will make the future. If we learn it. If we choose to stay in the old deceptions and live the lies and practice the manipulations and all of the bad things that the human race is known for throughout its history, then the future will always be full of strife and deception and conflict and murder and rape and all of the bad things that we would like to see disappear, or at least some of us. I choose to think the majority of us would like to see that happen. So I want you to know that I care about each and every one of you deeply. I care about this nation. I place two things above myself and my family. Always. And I am always in service to those two things. And then myself and my family, and my family always comes before self. Number one is God. Number two is the Constitution for the United States of America and the Bill of Rights, the principles and ideals upon which this country was founded. Why do I place those two things above my family? Well, number one, without the blessings of God, I could have nothing else. I could enjoy nothing else. I would not have the love of my family. Without the Constitution for the United States of America and the Bill of Rights, I could not worship my God. Someone would prevent me or kill me or try to force me to conform to their version of whatever their religion and their God happens to be. And without the protection of my rights, my Creator or God-given rights, by that Constitution and Bill of Rights, I could not live free. I could not have a family. I would not enjoy the blessings that that protection has given me and every other American citizen that's ever lived upon the face of this earth. We are truly the only people who have ever lived free. You can look around and you can see some people who look like they're free, but they're not. Never were. And unless we win our battle to maintain our constitutional Republican form of government, nobody's ever going to be free on this earth again. It's really what it's all about. So I just wanted you to know those things before I get into what we're going to talk about now. And that is the ancient religion and the people that are behind the destruction of the United States of America and our freedom. And many of them don't know that they're part of this destruction. For you see, you can't belong to this group, really, if you're not at the highest levels, without having been deceived into it, without having been lied to, without having been coerced at some level. For most of these people who are involved in this believe that they're doing the right thing for themselves and for humanity. They're like most people. They haven't investigated what they belong to. They haven't really studied the principles which they believe they are propounding. They have not studied history. They don't investigate. They find a mentor or a leader, someone whom they hear saying things that appeal to them. And this is the specialty of the Magi, the adepts of the mystery schools, the Illuminati, if you will. They practice magic, ladies and gentlemen, and magic is nothing more or less than the art of illusion. Deception. It's how to tell a lie and make it look like the truth, and make people believe it and follow it and practice it. And it began a long, 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 long time ago, and I have hashed through most of what you're going to hear today in my series on Mystery Babylon, which took many, many hours and several years to put together and research and air on this broadcast. But I have to recount a little bit of it, simply because there are so many new listeners who will not understand the real meat of this broadcast unless they have some preparation in the history of this group. You see, they believe not in what most people in this country believe. They believe principles and what they call truths that are completely different from the truths and principles that the rest of us believe in and adhere to. Some of them rightly and some of them wrongly. Some of them are deceptions. Many of us have lived our lives in deception simply because somebody told us that was the right thing to do without ever checking or investigating or knowing. Just one example that most men will identify with immediately, especially if you lived through the era of the Vietnam War. There were some of us who thought we were doing our duty and fighting for our country, who willingly went into the service and volunteered to fight in Vietnam and went off and did that. And years later, we found out it had nothing to do with our country whatsoever. We were fools. Many of us have grown out of that and understand these deceptions now. There was another class of people who understood that that war wasn't about America at all and didn't want to go. And some of them fled to Canada or other countries and committed a crime by not showing up when they were called for the draft or for registering for the draft. And some of them went ahead and registered for the draft, and when they were called to go down for their physicals, they went down there and went through all kinds of unbelievable manipulations and deceptions and game playing and head trips in order to try to be rejected by the military. Some of them pretended to be gay. Some of them were gay and for the first time admitted it and then later denied it and said they did it just to get out of going into the military. Some people actually broke arms and legs and really maimed themselves in order to get out of being inducted into military service. Others made up elaborate medical histories and got doctors, friends to go along with it in order to be disqualified. All of it because they were ignorant of the law, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody had to go to Canada. Nobody had to pretend that they were a homosexual. Nobody had to injure themselves or maim themselves in order to get out of being inducted into military service. All of them should have registered. When their draft number came up, they should have gone right down to the recruiting center and complied with everything that they were told to do, except for two things if they didn't want to go in. When it came time to sign the contract, all they had to do was say no. And when it came time to be sworn in and take the oath, all they had to do was stand in their spot when they were told to take one step forward. The act of taking one step forward is a voluntary act, which says that you volunteer. And executing the oath by repeating it when told to do so was the final action. No one, ladies and gentlemen, no law, no person can force you to sign any contract under any circumstances whatsoever. Now, they can tell you that they could. They could threaten you. They could do all kinds of nasty and mean things and call you all kinds of names. But when it comes right down to it, if it ever went into a court of law, it would be thrown out because you cannot be forced to enter into any contract ever or sign your name upon any piece of paper. And number two, you can never be made or forced to take any oath whatsoever under any circumstances by anybody for any reason. So all of those people who ran off to Canada and became criminals and couldn't come back to their country, and when they did, they had to be tried, and some of them went to jail for many years. Some of them had to do years of community service, and they were disgraced in their community. The people who maimed themselves and broke their arms and legs and mutilated their bodies. The people who invented elaborate medical histories that are with them to this day, harming them and harming their lives, interfering with their lives. None of them had to do any of it. They did it because they were ignorant of the law. All they had to do was go down, go through the rigmarole, get their physical, sit where they were told to sit, stand up when they were told to stand up. But just simply refused to sign their name on the contract, no matter what anybody says, no matter how bad they were threatened, refused to take one step forward, and refused to take the oath. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. We live our lives in fantasy land. And because we are ignorant, we suffer continually. We go to jail. We're ostracized. We lose opportunities. Our businesses fail. We pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in our lives in taxes that we are not required to pay under the law. And many, many other things. This is all brought about through lies, deception, manipulation, and rule through fear. I read an article recently in the Round Valley paper, here where I live. I'm talking to people all over the world. I know you're not acquainted with this little place where I live. It's one of the most beautiful spots on the face of this earth. I can't conceive that heaven would be any better than this place right here, as far as aesthetic beauty and pure healthiness. And the people. And we have a paper here that's put together by a man named Glenn Jacobs, one of my favorite people, a man who always sacrifices. And his family does without also, because he knows that to print that paper is the right thing to do, because it gives the people in this valley a true forum where everybody can say what they want to say. And where the truth isn't always presented in its entirety, but he does his very best to make sure that the truth is presented, and in most instances, it comes through glaringly. Much to the chagrin of a lot of socialists around here. In this paper, a man wrote a letter or a little article talking about the unlawful practices of some of the agencies of the federal government and how they do things under the color of law and cause us to do things out of fear and ignorance that we are not required, nor do we have to do. And shortly after that, in another issue, someone wrote a letter in response talking about, well, if I was single, I might do what you do, but, you know, if you really practice what you said, you'd be in jail. And, folks, I didn't write it. If you're thinking that it was me that wrote the original piece, it wasn't me. Then he went on to rave about how he has a family, and because he has a wife and children, he can't put himself at risk and do these things, even though they might be right, and all of this kind of stuff. And I'm sure somebody thought that that was a good argument that he put forward, but it wasn't. It was the railings of a man who got caught being a sheeple and he didn't like looking himself in the mirror. And so he struck out at the person who told the truth and wrote the truth in the newspaper, trying to make himself look good and feel good about why he was doing all the wrong things for the wrong reasons, mostly out of fear. For he kept citing the fact that if he did this and if he did that, he'd be in jail. Only if he was ignorant. And only if he didn't have the courage of his convictions. And folks, if you're doing the right thing before God and before man, and it's not a silly thing to do, there's nothing wrong with going to jail. Nothing at all. If you're married to a good woman, you have good children, and you've taught them right, they will survive while you're in jail. You see, most people knuckle under to tyranny for two reasons. One is ignorance. They've been taught wrong. They don't know any better. And the other is fear. Fear. If you fear any man, ladies and gentlemen, you are his slave. If you fear any government, you are the slave of that government. So to be afraid is to be enslaved. To be ignorant is also to be enslaved. But it's a different kind of slavery. You see, if you live your life in fear, if you know the truth, if you know what you should be doing and you don't do it because you're afraid, that is a most miserable life to lead. If you do it out of ignorance, you can even be happy in your enslavement, thinking that you are doing all the right things and that you are a good citizen and that everything's going to be okay in the long run. Nevertheless, you are a slave. Who is doing this to us? How did it come about? Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. Because I think, ladies and gentlemen, that it is imperative that you know the vast history here. Sometime in the dim, misty path of the human race, man didn't live as we live today. Man lived very much like the animals. If you believe in the Bible, man was made in the image of his creator and was endowed with the ability to talk and think and act on a level above the animals. If you believe in the theory of evolution, man at one time was an animal, unthinking, no intelligence, existing on instinct. It doesn't matter which one of these two you believe in, because what I'm talking about has nothing to do with your religion. It has to do with the religion of those who are lying to us, deceiving us, manipulating us, and have been doing so throughout the history of the world. Sometime back in that dim and misty past, one of these men discovered something that the rest of them didn't know. And it doesn't even matter what that was. If it was something that made their lives better, and only he could do or perform it, then everyone else who wanted to participate in that better life, in order to receive the benefit of his knowledge and his actions, had to conform to his dictates. And so this man became the first king, the first priest, and he founded the first religion. You can call it whatever religion you want. Religion of Ukulak, if you will. If his name was Bob, you could call it Bob's religion. But most likely, this man had also noticed the movement of the sun, the moon, and the stars in the heavens. And because, as far as we can trace back through history, this turns out to be the earliest religion that we can find, was the cosmology of the heavens. He could tell this group of people who depended upon his superior knowledge that this knowledge came from some mysterious deity or deities, and at that time it was probably plural from what we are able to research. He could say it came from the stars, or from that particular star to which he could point as it rose in the east at a certain time of the evening or night. He could attribute certain things that happened in nature to the movement of the sun and the moon. And he could predict through observation the tides. He could predict the coldest part of the winter. He could predict when the earth would begin to warm again, followed by the summer. And he could predict the coming of the fall and then the winter. He could tell people the most propitious time to plant crops. And maybe one day he was walking through the forest during a rainstorm, and a bolt of lightning struck a tree, and the tree burst into flames. And this man, having walked through burned forests before and eaten the flesh of cooked animals, decided to take a branch of this tree and preserve that flame and keep it burning. For there were no matches, ladies and gentlemen. If the fire went out, it was out forever until maybe another lightning bolt would strike near enough to them where they could get to it and preserve the fire again. The man who kept the fire was the keeper of the flame. Later in history, he became the priest, the head priest. And the most religions dating from the earliest point in history kept a perpetual flame burning upon the altar. And this came from the time when men did not know how to start a fire, and thus had to keep the flame alive. It became the most responsible position in the community. So the man responsible became the priest. Since the fire warmed, as the summer sun warmed the earth and brought forth plants, people saw God in the flames. And so this became the dwelling place for God. The followers of this religion became the philosophers of fire. They learned to manipulate those who could not put all of these things together and learn what they had learned with that knowledge. They learned how to deceive with two stories. One called the exoteric, or the outward garment, presented to those who are called the profane, the cattle, so to speak, the ones who could not use their intelligence and derive the same conclusions from observations of nature that the priests had done. And there was an esoteric presentation, which was confined to the priests, to the highest initiates of this religion, and it was the truth. The truth was used to manipulate the tribe or the nation, and even the family. Through the bending of the truth and the presentation to those being manipulated as an exoteric interpretation of the esoteric truth, most people live their lives believing the exoteric lie that is presented to them by philosophers, by governments, by priests, by churches, by religions, by pseudosciences, by movements. You see, the great threat to the establishment that Jesus Christ represented was not that he claimed to be king, not that he claimed to be the Messiah, and most historians will argue that he never made those claims, except once, when asked by Herod if he was the Messiah. He made a statement that many have interpreted as yes. The threat that Jesus Christ represented, ladies and gentlemen, to the government at that time in history was the truth. He said, "Seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free." He was breaking down the veil of the esoteric curtain behind which the truth was housed. He was teaching people the reality of the world. He really didn't want to threaten anyone, but the truth threatens everyone. That is why William Jefferson Clinton, the President of the United States of America, has named me, William Cooper, the most dangerous radio host in America. Because I don't get on here like other people do and just talk and say things that come in my head and have a guest on one week who says one thing and have a guest on the other week who says exactly the opposite. Nor do I have people on this broadcast who argue with each other about what the truth is. On this broadcast, I present you with the truth. I document it. I source it. When I have a guest, I make sure that the guest documents and sources what they say, and I make sure that they're telling the truth before they ever appear on this broadcast. And I've only been fooled a couple of times by people who were unmasked during the broadcast, because I'm a hard man to fool. Not because I'm better than anybody else, but because I've done so much research for so many years. It's pretty hard to fool me. But it's been done, and it'll probably be done again. The truth is the most important thing in this world. If you really want to understand the nature of God, try this. God is truth. Those who wish to pay the ultimate homage to God and to live their life following right teaching will simply engage in a lifelong quest for the truth. That simple, folks. It really is that simple. So throughout the history of the world, no matter what king has been on the throne, he never gained the throne without having been placed there by the priests of whatever religion really controlled the hearts and minds of the population. That is the truth. There has been no king who ever sat on any throne that did not have the blessings of the religion that was in power at the time. And some people have pointed to Henry VIII and James and all of these who defied the Catholic Church and say, "Well, you're wrong, Bill, because look at these guys." And no, I'm not wrong. Because the truth is that the hierarchy of the church in England supported the king. If they did not, they could have very simply dethroned the king with a wave of their hand to the people who followed the religion. You see, because throughout history, people's allegiance has been first to God and then to king. King sat on the throne through the blessings of the priesthood, who would claim that he had the divine right to rule given to him by God for some reason or other, usually hereditary. Most kings claimed descendancy from the house of David or from some other family which gave them, according to their beliefs, the right to rule the rest of the people. So, through the use of religion, philosophy, lies, deception, the hoarding, manipulation of technology, the philosophers of fire have, from the beginning, the very beginning, ruled the rest of humanity. It was the gift of fire to the human race that allowed man to create civilization. It was the gift of fire that created science and technology, that allowed man to smelt metals, that created the very first artificial weapons of war. You see, because they had weapons of war before that. They had sharpened sticks, and they had rocks and tree branches. The development of the spear was just a slight more efficient improvement on what they already had before. So, while you're pondering all of these things that I have told you just now, and I hope you understand them, but in this beginning, there sprang up the basis, the roots of all existing religions and philosophies that have been practiced, and there is nothing new, I guarantee you, under the sun. For out of those early days, the representation of the fire became to be the intellect, or the fire came to represent the intellect, which in heaven became the manifestation of the great mind as the sun. This all sprang up from man's great early struggle between the warmth of the day when he could see, when he was warm, when he could find food, and the night when it was dark and he was cold and he was hunted by predators. The struggle became known as the battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. The sun, when it rose in the east, was the savior of mankind. And when it set in the evening, the prince of darkness came out of the bowels of the earth and roamed over the land. Are you beginning to make connections? From all of these early beliefs and observations of man sprang ceremonies and societies and secret meetings where the smartest, the most promising, could be brought in as initiates. And the most promising of those would find their mentors who would help them up through the degrees of initiation, so that the priesthood could be perpetuated throughout the future of the world. They are known as the Adepts, the Magi, the Illumined Ones, the Sons of Light, the Philosophers of Fire, the Illuminati. And if you believe this is a myth, ladies and gentlemen, not only have you not done any research at all, but they have succeeded in their propaganda efforts to convince you that it is not the nature of man to conspire. And if you have a brain in your head at all, and if you have even looked around you even once in your life and observed the occupation, the principal occupation of most people, then you know that conspiracy is the principal nature of all mankind. Yeah. philosophers of fire, ladies and gentlemen, do not like to be exposed. They do not want to be undone, discovered, unmasked. They want us to live our lives hoodwinked, is their term for it. But many of us over the years have learned where to look and how to look, and we have found that there is nothing hidden about these people, even though their societies are secret, and their meetings are held in temples without windows, behind closed doors, guarded by the tiler with the sword. But they do have a language that is different from the language which we understand. They speak in an esoteric language made up of gematria, symbology, geometry, and parables. So the average, normal, everyday citizen can read their writings, and unless they understand the hidden language or the esoteric meaning of what they are reading, they get one tale, one story, when the truth is it tells an entirely different story for those who are well versed in the hidden language of the mystery religion of Babylon. I'm going to read to you now from three different sections of a book, an old book. You see, when you research these people, you must seek out their older writings. For their newer writings, they have scrubbed out anything. Not all, because even the newer writings, for those of us who understand the language, reveal great bits of their history and of truth concerning their real agendas. But the older editions of their works lay it all out in plain view for anybody who has studied their symbols and their esoteric language. I'm going to read to you now from three different parts of a new and revised edition, an encyclopedia of Freemasonry and its kindred sciences, comprising the whole range of arts, sciences, and literature as connected with the institutions, by Albert G. Mackey, M.D., 33rd degree. Author of The History of Freemasonry, Lexicon of Freemasonry, a textbook of Masonic jurisprudence, symbolism of Freemasonry, etc., etc. This new and revised edition, prepared under the direction and with the assistance of the late William J. Hugan, 32nd degree, past Grand Deacon, England, past Grand Warden, Egypt, past Grand Warden, Iowa, past Assistant Grand Sojourner, England, one of the founders, Quator Coronati Lodge, London, author of English Masonic Rite, Old Charges, etc., by Edward L. Hawkins, M.A., 30th degree. Profusely illustrated, Volume 2, published by the Masonic History Company, Chicago, New York, and London, 1924. I also have the edition from 1878. 1896, and 1909. If anyone knows where there is a volume or a two-volume set of the edition printed in 1873, I would certainly like to hear from you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in the early history of man, man was also fascinated not just with the heavens, but with the reproductive process of his own body. There were those who worshipped the feminine genitalia and those who worshipped the phallus, or the male genitalia. The priesthood generally presented both together as a symbol of the reality of the world. And these were metaphors when practiced in religion. They didn't actually really worship the human phallus or the human female genitalia. They were metaphors for the power of creation, the generative force. And for a good portion of the history of mankind, he engaged in what is known today as phallic worship. And I'm going to quote from page 560 of this book under the heading Phallic Worship. The phallus was a sculptured representation of the membrum viro, or male organ of generation. And the worship of it is said to have originated in Egypt, where after the murder of Osiris by Typhon, which is symbolically to be explained as the destruction or deprivation of the sun's light by night, Isis, his wife, or the symbol of nature, in the search for his mutilated body, is said to have found all the parts except the organs of generation, which myth is simply symbolic of the fact that the sun, having set its fecundating and invigorating power, had ceased. In other words, as the sun set, Osiris, murdered by Typhon, also known as Set, in the evening, on the horizon, or Horus, rising. See, you need to study all of this stuff to understand it. Then the Prince of Darkness took over. Man was without the generative or life-giving force represented by the phallus. The phallus, therefore, as the symbol of the male generative principle, was very universally venerated among the ancients, and that too as a religious rite without the slightest reference to any impure or lascivious application. So it had nothing to do with what a lot of people think it had to do with. It was a symbol of fertility. It was a symbol of the generative principle of nature. The worship of the phallus appears to have been very nearly universal amongst all peoples throughout the early history of mankind. In the mysteries, it was carried in solemn procession. The Jews, in their numerous deflections into idolatry, fell readily into that of this symbol. And they did this at a very early period of their history, for we are told that even in the time of the judges, Judges chapter 3, verse 7, they served Balaam and the groves. Balaam and the groves. Remember? The ceremonies must be performed. The sacrifice must be performed in a grove. Balaam is the Lord. The Lord, ladies and gentlemen, was Lucifer, or the sun. Now, the word translated here and elsewhere as groves, which in the exoteric meaning is a cup of trees, is in the original Asherah, and is by all modern interpreters supposed to mean a species of phallus. Thus, Movers says that Asherah is a sort of phallus erected to the telluric goddess Baaltes, and the learned Holloway had long before come to the same conclusion. But the phallus, or as it was called among the Orientalists, the lingam, was a representation of the male principle only. To perfect the circle of generation, the creative force, it is necessary to advance one step farther. Accordingly, we find in the Cetus of the Greeks and the Yoni of the Indians a symbol of the female generative principle of coextensive prevalence with the phallus. The Cetus was a circular and concave pedestal or receptacle upon which the phallus or column rested and from the center of which it sprang. The union of these two as the generative and the producing principles of nature in one compound figure was the most usual mode of representation. And here I think we undoubtedly find the remote origin of the point within a circle, an ancient symbol which was first adopted by the old sun worshippers and then by the ancient astronomers as a symbol of the sun surrounded by the earth or the universe, the sun as the generator and the earth as the producer, and afterward modified in its significance and incorporated into the symbolism of Freemasonry. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. If you go to any graveyard, you will see exactly what I have described to you. You will see a base or pedestal, the center of which is hidden and is concave, upon which is erected as a headstone a phallus or obelisk. You'll find these in any cemetery. They're not all Freemasons, ladies and gentlemen, for this is a symbol of the generative principle, the generative force, that is in use by all of the so-called fraternal orders, the mystery religions, the priests, the adepts, the Illuminati. In Dealey Plaza, you will find the same symbol. I didn't talk about that yesterday when the young lady, Jackie, called. There is the same thing, the pedestal with the phallus or the obelisk erected atop it. And the obelisk, if you count the blocks on the obelisk in Dealey Plaza, there's exactly 14, which is exactly the number of members of Osiris's body that Isis found and reassembled. And through a sort of spiritual or magical intercourse, became impregnated with the child Horus, which is the reborn father, or the sun rising as the savior of the world the following morning. And as he progresses through the heavens and finally reaches the zenith, where he is said to be doing God's work in the temple being the highest point in the heavens, represented by the obelisk in the temple of the sun when it casts no shadow. And then is reborn as his own father, who then sinks into the west and is murdered again by Typhon or Set, thus sun set on the horizon, or Horus rising, for as Osiris dies in the west, Horus, the child, is born, and as Osiris makes his way through the underworld, Osiris then becomes his own child and is reborn or resurrected or is reincarnated as his own son in the morning and brings again warmth and fertility to the earth. John F. Kennedy was killed in the Temple of the Sun in Dealey Plaza with all of this symbology there. It was the reason they had to make the jog from Main Street over to Elm Street so that he could be murdered in the grove. There is a reflecting pool by the obelisk, which is also the female principle, represents Isis. The reflecting pool reflects the image of the obelisk, or the male principle, representing the sun. In the heavens, the sun is the doctrine, the representation of the intellect. The moon, the sun is also Osiris, the moon, which reflects the pure light of her master, the sun, just like the reflecting pool, is Isis, or the church. And out of the mystical union between the two, the moon ruling over the night, where Isis brought together the 14 pieces of the murdered Osiris to produce the light of the moon, but was missing the generative force which prevented the sun from appearing at night, out of this mystical union between these two sprang the child Horus, the Savior of the world, or the sun rising on the golden dawn. The child Horus represents the full body of adepts or initiates, the Illuminati. I hope I've made that clear to you. The sun is the doctrine. The moon is the church. The sun is represented by the obelisk. The moon by the concave pedestal upon which it sits, or by the reflecting pool. The congregation is the Illuminati. Are you there? I hope that you understand all that I've just imparted to you. Now, we get into some heavy stuff, folks. You've got to understand who these people are and what they are about and what their symbology is. A lot of things that you've never understood before will become clear if you can follow along with me and understand what it is that I'm getting at. And I will explain as much as I possibly can in the time that we have left. If not, then I will finish tomorrow. Now I'm on page 722 of the same volume under the heading Stone of Foundation. This is very important. And I quote, "The Stone of Foundation constitutes one of the most important and abstruse of all the symbols of Freemasonry. It is referred to in numerous legends and traditions, not only of the Freemasons, but also of the Jewish rabbis, the Talmudic writers, and even the Muslim doctors." Muslim in that day was the term for the Muslim people. Muslim doctors was a representative of the high state of learning in the Arab world. The first colleges, the first universities that ever existed in the world were Arab. They continue, "Many of these, it must be confessed, are apparently puerile and absurd, but most of them, and especially the Masonic ones, are deeply interested in their allegorical signification. The Stone of Foundation is, properly speaking, a symbol of the higher degrees." Now, it's important that you understand this. The Stone of Foundation is, properly speaking, a symbol of the higher degrees, because we're going to go to a process here where they try to confound the profane with a bunch of gobbledygook, and then they tell you the truth. "It makes its first appearance in the Royal Ark and forms, indeed, the most important symbol of that degree, but it is so intimately connected in its legendary history with the construction of the Solomonic Temple that it must be considered as a part of ancient craft masonry, although he who confines the range of his investigations to the first three degrees will have no means within that narrow limit of properly appreciating the symbolism of the Stone of Foundation." Now, this is just saying in a polite way that the first three degrees of Freemasonry, and indeed all of the ones below the Royal Ark degree, really don't know the truth about the organization to which they belong. And they're going to repeat that admonition all through here. So if you know someone, or if you are a member of the Masonic Lodge in the first three degrees, or any of the degrees below the Royal Ark degree, you have to understand, or make that person understand, that they're being deluded. They have never been told the truth. They don't know what the truth is. And they're not going to learn the truth, most of them ever, because they're not considered worthy of it. They never will rise up that high. They'll never be one of the adept, one of the Illuminati, who really run things. And it's not just Freemasonry. Remember that. All of these fraternal orders, secret societies, and organizations that meet in secret or have secret doctrines at the highest levels are the same organization. And their masters or adepts are all known collectively as the Illuminati. "As preliminary to the inquiry, it is necessary to distinguish the Stone of Foundation, both in its symbolism and its legendary history, from other stones which play an important part in the Masonic ritual, but which are entirely distinct from it. Such are the cornerstone,
which was always placed in the northeast corner of the building about to be erected, and to which such a beautiful reference is made in the ceremonies of the first degree, or the keystone, which constitutes an interesting part of the Mark Master's degree, or lastly, the capstone, upon which all the ritual of the most excellent master's degree is founded. There are all in their proper places, highly interesting and instructive symbols, but have no connection whatever with the stone of foundation, whose symbolism is our present object to discuss. Nor, although the stone of foundation is said, for peculiar reasons, to have been of a cubical form, must it be confounded with that stone called by the continental masons the cubical stone, the prior cubique of the French, and the cubic stein of the German masons, but which in the English system is known as the perfect ashlar. The stone of foundation has a legendary history and a symbolic signification which are peculiar to itself and which differ from the history and meaning which belong to these other stones. I propose first to define this Masonic stone of foundation, then to collate the legends which refer to it, and afterward to investigate its significance as a symbol, which finally is the revelation of the esoteric truth of the symbol. To the Mason who takes a pleasure in the study of the mysteries of his institution, the investigation cannot fail to be interesting if it is conducted with any ability. Now listen to what I just said. To the Mason who takes a pleasure in the study of the mysteries of his institution, the investigation cannot fail to be interesting if it is conducted with any ability, which means knowledge of the esoteric or secret language of the symbols. Otherwise, the investigator will understand nothing of the truth of the matter. But in the very beginning, as a necessary preliminary to any investigation of this kind, it must be distinctly understood that all that is said of this stone of foundation in Masonry is to be strictly taken in a mythical or allegorical sense. Dr. Oliver, while undoubtedly himself knowing that it was simply a symbol, has written loosely of it as though it were a substantial reality, and hence, if the passages in his historical landmarks and in his other works which refer to this celebrated stone are accepted by his readers in a literal sense, they will present absurdities and puerilities which would not occur if the stone of foundation was received, as it really is, as a myth conveying a most profound and beautiful symbolism. It is as such that it is to be treated here, and therefore, if a legend is recited or a tradition related, the reader is requested on every occasion to suppose that such legend or tradition is not intended as the recital or relation of what is deemed a fact in Masonic history, but to wait with patience for the development of the symbolism which it conveys. Read in this spirit, as are all the legends of Masonry, should be read. The legend of the Stone of Foundation becomes one of the most important and interesting of all of the Masonic symbols. Now, if you think this isn't important, ladies and gentlemen, just think how many times you have seen the representation symbology of this stone in your lives and did not understand what it meant. And if you saw the movie 2001, you saw the Stone of Foundation. It appeared before the cave in which the apes were huddled. That's right. It also appeared on the moon. When man reached the moon and began digging, he found, again, this mysterious black stone. And again, when they traveled to the planet Jupiter, there it was, orbiting around Jupiter, this huge black monolith, into which the astronaut finally was able to peer, and what he saw was another universe. Most people who saw the movie 2001 did not understand any of it. It was a message in symbolism from the adepts of the Illuminati to the other adepts of the Illuminati, and could only be understood by those who know the esoteric secret language of the mystery religions. You also see it if you visit Las Vegas and go into the Luxor Hotel, which is nothing more than a gigantic temple of initiation into which pour the profane tourists from all around the globe. And after spending several days there going through the 3 degrees of initiation, represented by the 3 entertainment facilities there, and wandering around, being indoctrinated into the exoteric meaning of the esoteric language by all the symbolism, depart several days later as Freemasons without portfolio. And there in the Luxor Hotel is once again a huge, black, smooth, perfectly polished representation of the Stone of Foundation. What is this all about? Well, it's about an awful lot, folks. You had better learn it, because it is important. Because they are manipulating you with all of this, and you don't even know it. The Stone of Foundation is supposed, by the theory which establishes it, to have been a stone placed at one time within the foundations of the Temple of Solomon, and afterward, during the building of the second temple, transported to the Holy of Holies. It was in form a perfect cube and had inscribed upon its upper face, within a delta or triangle, the sacred tetragrammaton, or ineffable name of God. Now, don't get all bent out of shape here and think that they're talking about the same God you're talking about, because they're not, and it will become evident. Oliver, speaking with the solemnity of an historian, says that Solomon thought that he had rendered the house of God worthy, so far as human adornment could effect, for the dwelling of God. When he had placed the celebrated Stone of Foundation, on which the sacred name was mystically engraven, with solemn ceremonies, in that sacred depository on Mount Moriah, along with the foundations of Dan and Asher, the center of the most holy place, where the ark was overshadowed by the Shekinah of God, the Hebrew Talmudist, who thought as much of this stone and had as many legends concerning it as the Masonic Talmudists, called it Ibn Shalaha, our Stone of Foundation, because, as they said, it had been laid by Jehovah as the foundation of the world. And hence the apocryphal book of Enoch speaks of the stone which supports the corners of the earth. This idea of a foundation stone of the world was most probably derived from that magnificent passage of the book of Job, chapter 38, verses 4 through 7, in which the Almighty demands of Job, quote, "Where wast thou when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare, since thou hast such knowledge. Who fixed its dimensions, since thou knowest? Or who stretched out the line upon it? Upon what were its foundations fixed? And who laid its cornerstone, when the morning stars sang together, all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Noyes, whose translation I have adopted, is not materially differing from the common version, but far more poetical and more in the strain of the original, thus explains the allusions to the foundation stone. Quote, "It was the custom to celebrate the laying of the cornerstone of an important building with music, songs, shouting, etc. Hence the morning stars are represented as celebrating the laying of the cornerstone of the earth." End quote. Upon this meager statement has been accumulated more traditions than appertain to any other Masonic symbol. The rabbis, as has already been intimated, divided the glory of these apocryphal histories with the Masons. Indeed, there's good reason for a suspicion that nearly all the Masonic legends owe their first existence to the imaginative genius of the writers of the Jewish Talmud, and that is true. But there is this difference between the Hebrew and the Masonic traditions, that the Talmudic scholar recited them as truthful histories and swallowed in one gulp of faith all their impossibilities and anachronisms, while the Masonic scholar has received them as allegories whose value is not in the facts, but in the sentiments which they convey. And ladies and gentlemen, that shows you that even such a learned man as Albert Mackey could be confused and ignorant of the facts. For the Talmudic writers, the followers of the mysteries of Judaism, did not ever recite them as truthful histories and swallow them in one gulp of faith. They knew their impossibilities and anachronisms, for they are one of the original inventors and users of the esoteric or hidden language. And in specific, I'm speaking of gematria. With this understanding of their meaning, let us proceed to a collation of these legends. In that blasphemous work, the Toldeth Jeshu, or Life of Jesus, written, it is supposed, in the 13th or 14th century, we find the following account of this wonderful stone. Quote, "At that time, the time of Jesus, there was in the house of the sanctuary, that is, the temple, a stone of foundation, which is the very stone that our father Jacob anointed with oil, as it is described in the 28th chapter of the book of Genesis. On that stone, the letters of the Tetragrammaton were inscribed, and whosoever of the Israelites should learn that name would be able to master the world." Now you're getting to a little bit of some of the ultimate meaning of this. "To prevent, therefore, anyone from learning these letters, two iron dogs were placed upon two columns in front of the sanctuary. If any person, having acquired the knowledge of these letters, desired to depart from the sanctuary, the barking of the dogs by magical power inspired so much fear that he suddenly forgot what he had acquired." This passage is cited by the learned Buxthorpe in his Lexicon Talmudicum, but in my copy of the Toldeth Jeshu, I find another passage which gives some additional particulars in the following words. Quote, "At that time there was in the temple the ineffable name of God inscribed upon the stone of foundation. For when King David was digging the foundation for the temple, he found in the depths of the excavation a certain stone on which the name of God was inscribed. This stone he removed and deposited it in the Holy of Holies." End quote. The same puerile story of the barking dogs is repeated still more at length. It is not pertinent to the present inquiry, but it may be stated as a mere matter of curious information, that this scandalous book, which is throughout a blasphemous defamation, proceeds to say that he cunningly obtained a knowledge of the Tetragrammaton from the stone of foundation, and by its mystical influence was enabled to perform his miracles. The Masonic legends of the stone of foundation, based on these and other rabbinical reveries, are of the most extraordinary character, if they are to be viewed as histories, but readily reconcilable with sound sense, if looked at only in the light of allegories. They present an uninterrupted succession of events in which the stone of foundation takes a prominent part from Adam to Solomon and from Solomon to Zerubbabel. Thus, the first of these legends in order of time relates that the stone of foundation was possessed by Adam while in the Garden of Eden, that he used it as an altar and so reverenced it that on his expulsion from paradise, he carried it with him into the world in which he and his descendants were afterward to earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. Another legend informs us that from Adam the stone of foundation descended to Seth. From Seth it passed by regular succession to Noah, who took it with him into the ark, and after the subsidence of the deluge, made on it his first thank offering. Noah left it on Mount Ararat, where it was subsequently found by Abraham, who removed it and constantly used it as an altar of sacrifice. His grandson, Jacob, took it with him when he fled to his uncle Laban in Mesopotamia and used it as a pillow when in the vicinity of Luz he had his celebrated vision. Here, there is a sudden interruption in the legendary history of the stone, and we have no means of conjecturing how it passed from the possession of Jacob into that of Solomon. Moses, it is true, is said to have taken it with him out of Egypt at the time of the Exodus, and thus it may have finally reached Jerusalem. Dr. Adam Clark repeats what he very properly calls a foolish tradition, that the stone on which Jacob rested his head was afterward brought to Jerusalem, thence carried after a long lapse of time to Spain, from Spain to Ireland, and from Ireland to Scotland, where it was used as a seat on which the kings of Scotland sat to be crowned. Edward I, we know, brought a stone to which this legend is attached from Scotland to Westminster Abbey, where under the name of Jacob's Pillow it still remains until recently, ladies and gentlemen, but according to this book, It still remains and is always placed under the chair upon which the British sovereign sits to be crowned. Because there is an old distich which declares that wherever this stone is found, the Scottish kings shall reign. But this Scottish tradition would take the stone of foundation away from all its Masonic connections, and therefore it is rejected as a Masonic legend. Well, the kings and queens don't think it's a legend, ladies and gentlemen. And recently, the stone was returned by the government of England, by the crown, by Queen Elizabeth, to the country of Scotland, from which it was taken centuries ago. And this is taken, ladies and gentlemen, as a symbol that the Scottish Rite, or the Illuminati, prevail in the battle for the world. Is that the truth? Only the ones at the very top really know what the truth is concerning themselves and their activities in their entirety. Some of us know some of the truth concerning these people, and that's what I'm trying to impart to you now. All of these legends, just related, are in many respects contradictory and unsatisfactory. And another series, equally as old, is now very generally adopted by Masonic scholars as much better suited to the symbolism by which all these legends are explained. This series of legends commences with the patriarch Enoch, who is supposed to have been the first consecrator of the Stone of Foundation. The legend of Enoch is so interesting and important in this connection as to excuse its repetition in the present work. The legend in full is as follows. Enoch, under the inspiration of the Most High, and in obedience to the instructions which he had received in a vision, built a temple underground on Mount Moriah and dedicated it to God. His son, Methuselah, constructed the building, although he was not acquainted with his father's motives for the erection. This temple consisted of 9 vaults situated perpendicularly beneath each other and communicating by apertures left in each vault. Enoch then caused a triangular plate of gold to be made, each side of which was a cubit long. He enriched it with the most precious stones and encrusted the plate upon a stone of agate of the same form. On the plate he engraved the true name of God, or the Tetragrammaton, and placing it on a cubical stone, known thereafter as the Stone of Foundation, he deposited the whole within the lowest arc. When the subterranean building was completed, he made a door of stone, and attaching to it a ring of iron, by which it might be occasionally raised, he placed it over the opening of the uppermost ark, and so covered it that the aperture could not be discovered. Enoch himself was permitted to enter it but once a year, and on the deaths of Enoch, Methuselah, and Lamech, and the destruction of the world by the deluge, all knowledge of the vault or subterranean temple, and of the stone of foundation, with the sacred and ineffable name inscribed upon it, was lost for ages to the world. At the building of the first temple of Jerusalem, the stone of foundation again makes its appearance. Reference has already been made to the Jewish tradition that David, when digging the foundations of the temple, found in the excavation which he was making a certain stone, on which the ineffable name of God was inscribed, and which stone he is said to have removed and deposited in the Holy of Holies. That King David laid the foundations of the temple upon which the superstructure was subsequently erected by Solomon is a favorite theory of the legend mongers of the Talmud. The Masonic tradition is substantially the same as the Jewish, but it substitutes Solomon for David, thereby giving a greater air of probability to the narrative, and it supposes that the stone thus discovered by Solomon was the identical one that had been deposited in his secret vault by Enoch. This stone of foundation, the tradition states, was subsequently removed by King Solomon and for wise purposes deposited in a secret and safer place. In this, the Masonic tradition again agrees with the Jewish, for we find in the 3rd chapter of the Treatise on the Temple the following narrative, quote, "There was a stone in the Holy of Holies on its west side on which was placed the Ark of the Covenant and before the pot of manna and Aaron's rod. But when Solomon had built the temple, and foresaw that it was at some future time to be destroyed, he constructed a deep and winding vault underground for the purpose of concealing the ark, wherein Hosea afterwards, as we learn in the 2nd book of Chronicles, chapter 35, verse 3, deposited it with the pot of manna, the rod of Aaron, and the oil of anointing. The Talmudical book, Yama, gives the same tradition and says that, quote, the Ark of the Covenant was placed in the center of the Holy of Holies upon a stone rising 3 fingers' breadth above the floor to be, as it were, a pedestal for it. This stone, says Prideaux in his Old and New Testament, Connected, Volume 1, page 148, the rabbins called the Stone of Foundation and give us a great deal of trash about it. End quote. There is much controversy as to the question of the existence of any ark in the Second Temple. Some of the Jewish writers assert that a new one was made, others that the old one was found where it had been concealed by Solomon, and others again contend that there was no ark at all in the Temple of Zerubbabel, but that its place was supplied by the Stone of Foundation on which it had originally rested. Royal Ark Masons well know how all these traditions are sought to be reconciled by the Masonic legend in which the substitute ark and the Stone of Foundation play so important a part. In the 13th degree of the ancient and accepted rite, the Stone of Foundation is conspicuous as the resting place of the sacred Delta. Remember Delta Force, a la Colonel Greitz? In the Royal Ark and Select Master's degrees of the American rite, the Stone of Foundation constitutes the most important part of the ritual. In both of these, it is the receptacle of the Ark, on which the ineffable name is inscribed. Lee, in his Temple of Solomon, has devoted a chapter to the Stone of Foundation, and thus recapitulates the Talmudic and rabbinical traditions on the subject. Quote, vain and futilis are the feverish dreams of the ancient rabbins concerning the foundation stone of the temple. Some assert that God placed this stone in the center of the world for a future basis and settled consistency for the earth to rest upon. Others held this stone to be the first matter out of which all the beautiful visible things, beings of the world, have been hewn forth and produced to light. Others relate that this was the very same stone laid by Jacob for a pillow under his head in that night when he dreamed of an angelic vision at Bethel and afterwards anointed and consecrated it to God. That should be pronounced Bethel, folks. Which when Solomon had found, no doubt, by forged revelation or some tedious search like another Rabbi Selema, he durst not but lay it sure as the principal foundation stone of the temple. Nay, they say further, he caused to be engraved upon it the Tetragrammaton, or the ineffable name of Jehovah. It will be seen that the Masonic traditions on the subject of the Stone of Foundation do not differ very materially from these rabbinical ones, although they add a few additional circumstances. In the Masonic legend, the foundation stone first makes its appearance, as we have already said, in the days of Enoch, who placed it in the bowels of Mount Moriah. There, it was subsequently discovered by King Solomon, who deposited it in a crypt of the first temple, where it remained concealed until the foundations of the second temple were laid, when it was discovered and removed to the Holy of Holies. But the most important point of the legend of the Stone of Foundation is its intimate and constant connection with the Tetragrammaton, or ineffable name. It is this name inscribed upon it, within the sacred and symbolic delta, that gives to the stone all its Masonic value and significance. It is upon this fact that it was so inscribed that its whole symbolism depends. Looking at these traditions in anything like the light of historical narratives, we are compelled to consider them, to use the plain language of Lee, quote, but as so many idle and absurd conceits, end quote. We must go behind the legend, which we acknowledge at once to be only an allegory, and study its symbolism. Now, for those of you, ladies and gentlemen, who think that this is a waste of time, bear in mind, you have already seen this stone 3 times in a movie called 2001. You did not understand its significance or even what you were looking at or the message of the movie. If you tell me you did, I'm going to ask you to explain it to me, and you're going to find yourself extremely embarrassed. You see it in Las Vegas if you go to the Luxor Hotel. It is there, right in front of everyone. And in the center, there's a huge obelisk that from time to time shoots a beam of light directly up to the center where a huge X crosses at the very top of the hotel. And at night, it shoots up into the heavens. If you go to the United Nations meditation room, you will also see this same stone. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, occupying the center position of the meditation room, which is itself shaped as a truncated pyramid with the capstone missing. Now, if you believe sincerely that Stanley Kubrick made that movie 2001 and inserted that stone as a central theme of the meaning of that motion picture, one of the greatest of all time, and if you believe that they erected the Luxor Hotel with all its symbology and placed the stone of foundation in that hotel, overshadowing and overpowering everything, and if you sincerely believe that it rests in the meditation room of the United Nations and that this is unimportant and a waste of time, then, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that they're right when they say you are cattle. For most of you, I know that you already understand the significance and do not fit into that category. For those of you who do, I would suggest at this time that you turn off your radio because you've wasted enough of your time. The following facts, I think, can be readily established from history. First, that there was a very general prevalence among the earliest nations of antiquity of the worship of stones as the representatives of the deity. Secondly, that in almost every ancient temple there was a legend of a sacred or mystical stone. Thirdly, that this legend is found in the Masonic system. And lastly, that the mystical stone there has received the name of the, quote, stone of foundation, end quote. Now, as in all other systems, the stone is admitted to be symbolic, and the traditions connected with it mystical. We are compelled to assume the same predicates of the Masonic stone. It, too, is a symbolic, and its legend a myth or an allegory. Of the fable, myth, or allegory, Bailey has said that, quote, subordinate to history and philosophy, it only deceives that it may better instruct us. Listen to this. They admit that they lie. Of the fable, myth, or allegory, Bailey has said that, quote, subordinate to history and philosophy, it only deceives that it may the better instruct us. Faithful in preserving the realities which are confided to it, it covers with its seductive envelope the lessons of the one and the truths of the other, end quote. So you see, they believe that they are the only truly mature minds. They deceive everyone else. To each other they tell the truth, and they learn the lessons of the one and the truths of the other. It is from this standpoint that we are to view the allegory of the stone of foundation as developed in one of the most interesting and important symbols of masonry. The fact that the mystical stone in all the ancient religions was a symbol of the deity leads us necessarily to the conclusion that the stone of foundation was also a symbol of deity. And this symbolic idea is strengthened by the Tetragrammaton, our sacred name of God, that was inscribed upon it. The ineffable name sanctifies the stone upon which it is engraved as the symbol of the grand architect. It takes from it its heathen signification as an idol and consecrates it to the worship of the true God. The predominant idea of the deity in the Masonic system connects him with his creative and formative power. God is to the Freemason Al-Gabil, as the Arabians called him. That is, quote, the builder, end quote, or as expressed in his Masonic title, the grand architect of the universe. By common consent, abbreviated in the formula G-A-O-T-U. Now, it is evident that no symbol could so appropriately suit him in this character as the stone of foundation upon which he is allegorically supposed to have erected his world. Such a symbol closely connects the creative work of God as a pattern, as exemplar, with the workman's erection of his temporal building on a similar foundation stone. But this Masonic idea is still further to be extended. The great object of all Masonic labor is, quote, divine truth, end quote. The search for the lost word is the search for truth. But divine truth is a term synonymous with God. The ineffable name is a symbol of truth because God and God alone is truth. It is properly a scriptural idea. The book of Psalms abounds with this sentiment. Thus it is said that the truth of the Lord reacheth unto the clouds, and that his truth endureth unto all generations. If then God is truth, and the stone of foundation is the Masonic symbol of God, it follows that it must also be the symbol of divine truth. When we have arrived at this point in our speculations, we are ready to show how all the myths and legends of the Stone of Foundation may be rationally explained as parts of that beautiful, quote, science of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols, end quote, which is the acknowledged definition and religion of Freemasonry. In the Masonic system, there are two temples. The first temple, in which the degrees of ancient craft masonry are concerned, and the second temple, with which the higher degrees, and especially the royal ark, are related. The first temple is symbolic of the present life. The second temple is symbolic of the life to come. And in between, there is a symbolic death and rebirth, and a raising by the grip of the lion's paw. The first temple, the present life, must be destroyed on its foundations. The second temple, the life eternal, must be built. Ordo ab Cao. But the mystical stone was placed by King Solomon in the foundations of the first temple. That is to say, the first temple of our present life must be built on the sure foundation of divine truth, for other foundation can no man lay. But although the present life is necessarily built upon the foundation of truth, yet we never thoroughly attain it in this sublunary sphere. The foundation stone is concealed in the first temple, and the master mason knows it not. He has not the true word. He receives only a substitute, and there is one of the greatest admissions that they ever make, that they do not tell the truth to the lower degrees. Let me read that again. The foundation stone is concealed in the first temple, and the master mason knows it not. He has not the true word. He receives only a substitute. The Blue Lodge exists in deception. But in the second temple of the future life, we have passed from the grave which had been the end of our labors in the first. We have removed the rubbish and have found that stone of foundation which had been hitherto concealed from our eyes. We now throw aside the substitute for truth which had contented us in the former temple, and the brilliant effulgence of the Tetragrammaton and the Stone of Foundation are discovered, and thenceforth we are the possessors of the true word of divine truth. And in this way, the Stone of Foundation, or divine truth, concealed in the first temple, but discovered and brought to light in the second, will explain that passage of the Apostle, quote, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face, now I know in part, but then I shall know face to face," end quote. And so the result of this inquiry is that the Masonic Stone of Foundation is a symbol of divine truth upon which all speculative masonry is built. And the legends and traditions which refer to it are intended to describe in an allegorical way the progress of truth in the soul, the search for which is a mason's labor, and the discovery of which is his reward. And the discovery, ladies and gentlemen, is that man was held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust and vindictive God. He was set free from the bonds, the chains of ignorance, by Lucifer, that great angel of light, through his agent Satan, with the gift of intellect. And through the use of that intellect, man will conquer nature and the universe. And man himself will become God. Good night. And God bless each and every single one of you. And may God in his infinite wisdom save this great republic. And may you learn to live your lives in the truth. I make no judgment on the correctness or the falsity of the doctrine that I have just given you, except to say that is what those who are in control believe. They are secular humanists. Their goal is to destroy all existing nation states, all existing religions, bind the mob, and rule the world in their utopian socialist state under the United Nations. The great secret of the Knights Templars, ladies and gentlemen, is that the stone of foundation, or Jacob's pillow, was taken to Ireland by Joseph of Arimathea, along with the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail was the womb of a woman, wherein the descendants of Jesus Christ in the house of David sprang forth and created the Merovingian line of French kings, from which most of the ruling classes of Europe are related. The House of Stuart makes the same claim. He who does not know history is doomed to repeat it. Everything that is happening today, ladies and gentlemen, is based upon events that happened hundreds and thousands of years ago, which most of you know absolutely nothing about. And that is the great shame of it all. For you can't do anything about anything that you know nothing about. This is the Voice of Freedom. You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. The Hour of the Time is also carried by WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 99.55 kHz, Monday through Friday night, 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
We now return you to All Oldies, Most of the Time.
I sit in my room, looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I'm thinking of our lost romance and how it should have been. Oh, if we only could start over again. I know you never forgive me, dear, for running out on you. I was wrong to take a chance with somebody new. I sit in my room, looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals, they cover my window pane. I know you'll never forgive me, dear, for running out on you. Oh, I long to do the things we used to do. I'm lonely and I'm blue, yet I'll try to get along without you.
Nasty dog.